Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM with Gillette. When we show our best side, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
Game on 2FM.
It's Tuesday the 5th of May.
Coming up today, Ireland's Kevin Doyle explains why football needs to come back.
Good win from Birch there. Bacci, plenty to do. Real battle there with Bernardes. Birch in looking for Doyle! Kevin Doyle! And he's made a massive return!
Game on 2FM with Gillette. When we show our best side, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
Game on 2FM.
Yeah, Marie, usually we play that thing where we read out all the intros, but you just threw it out a bit early today. But Mark Langdon's on the show as well. He's going to reveal just how close European football actually really is.
And we'll have Ken Doherty reliving his greatest sporting day.
Oh, it was the most incredible experience. You know, you've worked so hard and been a professional for this is my seventh season. And for it to become a realisation for me to lift the trophy was just an incredible. It was like a dream come true, and it happened, and I couldn't believe it really. And it was just fantastic, and it was the perfect way to finish.
And world silver medalist Nikki Daly talks about the Olympics and Formula Female at Mondello Park.
Game on 2FM.
All that and much, much more between now and 7 o'clock. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Ruby, I know we've been positive pretty much about the potential of sport coming back, but every now and again we'll get a little bit of a blow. And there was a little bit of a setback today with World Rugby's medical guidelines stating that there will have to be a vaccine and before rugby comes back to spectators, that it'll be behind closed doors until that vaccine has been found. And even though it's a bit of a roadmap and it's a date or something certainty, it will eventually come back, which is positive.
It will. I suppose it's probably a huge financial blow to the RFUs, really, more so than it's disappointing for fans. It would be great to have games on, but it'll be a huge loss of revenue for all the different rugby football unions around the world. And even if you look at the IRFU, Marie, like who's to know, will South Africa, Australia or Japan even be allowed to come here for the Autumn Internationals in November? But you will be hoping by next spring that England and France could have come to the Aviva for their Six Nations games, and England and France at home, like they're guaranteed sellouts for the IRFU. So you know, they're facing huge financial pressure and strain. And when you look at it, 81% of the revenue for the IRFU comes from the men's senior team, so they're going to be under a fair bit of pressure.
The numbers are actually staggering, really, aren't they, Ruby, when you think of the figures? I know, we always knew that the men's game brought in so much money, but you know, when you're looking at up in the 80s for just the match revenue, really, it's pretty phenomenal.
It is, and I suppose, I don't know, is that it? Surely the 81% consists of media rights money and sponsorship, etc. But it is a huge portion of their income, so they're going to be under pressure. I know World Rugby do have a €92 million COVID-19 fund and a relief fund, and I think a lot of the RFUs or rugby football unions will be dipping into that.
Yeah, Bill Sweeney from the RFU, the chief executive, said that if the Six Nations don't go ahead in October and November, that they could lose €107 million if they're cancelled.
I know, it's huge money, but that's going to be every industry, not just sport, around the world. So who knows what the financial costs are going to end up being when all this is said and done. But look, everyone's welfare has to come first. I actually did find it interesting reading the guidelines for players to go back training in rugby. Players have to wear gloves, face masks and refrain from physical contact during sessions. So the senior rugby players are going playing tag.
Like, okay, with rugby I can see it a little bit, maybe having the gloves on. But what if you're a hurler and something similar comes in like that? Like, it'd be very hard to go catching the slitter with the gloves.
Roy, would not stop the slitter stinging the hand off you.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be the main reason, though, for wearing them. I just think that it would be difficult enough when you're not used to catch such a small ball with a glove on.
I think it could become an advantage. You could get a very fine pair of gloves. Wet slitter wouldn't be dropping as much. I think it could be an advantage.
Is somebody out there now making a prototype for gloves? Because they're all going to have to wear them.
I know, yeah. Red ones and yellow ones, stripy ones, little Kenny hurlers. These clothes could become fashion items.
Snoods. They'll all be wearing snoods as well. We can give up this radio now and go off and manufacture the gear that you need to get back playing.
Yeah, I think that's gone beyond my imagination, Marie. But anyway, where's Donegal when you need him?
Totally. So our first guest today is Kevin Doyle. I played a little clip of him earlier and I do have another one up my sleeve, so I'm going to hit that one now.
O'Shea. It's Doyle! Brilliant! Right out of the top drawer! It's a fantastic goal from Kevin Doyle!
What a strike! He's spun on it, fired it into the top corner. What a great finish!
Well, I was delighted to pick up the papers the other day and see somebody with as positive an attitude as I have to getting sport back, and we need it, and that is Kevin Doyle. How are you?
Good, Ruby, and yourself?
Oh, hanging in there, thank God.
Kevin, you should be a little bit worried now when Ruby is seeing you as a kindred spirit.
Yeah, I know, I knew to go back a long way for that clip, Marie, as well. everyone needs something to cling to. Sport is such a massive thing in everyone's lives. I understand some sports are different. You were talking about rugby, I was listening in the background, you're talking about the rugby, a bit more close contact soccer. But the top level anyway, rugby be it soccer, you know, whether the players have close contact or not, they can isolate. Like, you spend, and getting onto a sort of a different point here, but if you're in a national team, or you spend most of your life as a top whatever sportsman in a hotel anyway. So just say the Premier League going forward in the next few weeks, why can't they be isolated in a hotel, go out and play their games, come back isolated in a hotel? Whoever's involved in that massive squad, physios, doctors, you would be isolated for 2 months if you were going to a World Cup, whatever, treated like that for the next 2 months, get the games on. For everyone at home, slightly, obviously we're slightly biased, but you want to see sport. It gives everyone something to be excited about, to be interested in. You know, there's only so much Netflix you can watch. As important, listen, I'm not affected by it down here as much. We don't see too many people infected, or no one close to me has been infected or got really sick, so maybe I'm a little bit more relaxed than I should be. But I think the top teams anyway can afford to spend the money to keep themselves isolated, do the right things, too, as much as you can possibly do. Like, how long are we going to go on? We don't know if there's going to be a vaccine or not a vaccine. How long do you go on not having sport? You know, so there's going to come a point where we have to just say, you know what, we have to live our lives, do as well as we can, social distance as well as we can, do as many right things as we can. For example, I know from Premier League, I'm sure it's the same with Ruby horse racing, going into a Premier League dressing room, you know, to get there, you had to squirt antiseptic on your hands 3 or 4 times the amount of doors you have to go through. They were very wary about any virus getting into the club, anyone getting sick, anyone who phoned in was told not to come near the place. You know, so before any of this ever happened, it's very, very, you know, I suppose, strict on spreading any sort of virus or bacteria or whatever, and that's only going to be ramped up. And I just think there's ways around it. We can always be doom and gloom and say, no, the world is never going to be the same again, and, you know, but you have to just get on, you know. Could have said about that about anything in history. Football, sports stopped for World War II. Everything was not going to be the same again, and it just comes again. You go again. I suppose I have a more positive outlook. People need to, lots of people anyway, the majority of people enjoy sport, whatever it may be. I'm not just talking about football. I'm talking about everything. Hurling, rugby, racing, golf. You know, more sports are suited to social distancing than others. I just think there's a way around this, especially for the richer sports, the ones with more money involved can afford to take the measures needed. So that was my basic, very basic view on it.
I completely concur with you. Kevin, teasing it out a bit further, do you think that Premier League clubs, with all the fans they have, there is an onus on them to go about it to entertain their fans, is what you've said, but how do big clubs like that go about keeping their fans away, even if games are behind closed doors? How do you stop Liverpool fans from congregating when they're going to win the league?
There's going to have to be a ring around, you know, a perimeter around the stadium a couple of miles away from it. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, there's so many issues. But there's ways around that. You know, they're sensible. The majority of people are sensible and they know the story, they know the score. If there's plenty of warnings put out, you'll always get a couple of gobshites. But in the main, I think you can deal with it. Like, it's annoying me seeing, oh, just cancel the season, move on, we'll start next season. Why is this season not as important as next season? Why can't we finish this season? People say, oh, Sky contracts. And Sky will wait. You know, they've nothing with it, the Premier League. They've no choice. If the Premier League say, we're finishing the season, you'll call their bluff. it's, you know, I'm not a Liverpool fan, I'm a Man United fan. I should be happy the season is bloody finished, but you want the season to be finished. Liverpool deserve to win a league. It's never going to be the same from now, no matter what happens, but they should be given the chance to go out and finish it. This season, in my opinion, is just as important. You know, everyone just say, oh, forget about it now. Well, forget about the start of next season. Get this season done. Get on to next year. And the majority of people, fans, the tone that come to the stadiums, they will abide by that, you know, and the few that don't, well, that's what you have police for. And as I said, players treated like a World Cup or a European Championship, cocoon them, get this season out of the way, kick the can down the road, cocoon them for the 6 weeks that'll take 5 weeks, I think. Play every 4 days, you've about 9 games for Liverpool left, get that out of the way. You know, everyone will come up with issues and problems, but they can be all sorted. Like, it's too many people, I suppose, and I'm another one now, Gavin, my opinion, but too many people have different opinions. They need one person at the top of the Premier League to just come out, this is what we're doing. You know, the PFA rep, Gordon Taylor, was coming out today saying maybe we'll play 30 minutes a half and stupid stuff like that. Just, you know, one voice and give us a date, the 1st of June, whatever it may be, and let's go for 5 weeks to get it out of the way to finish off this season and then worry about next season. Hopefully in 5 weeks' time, if a lot happens, there might be more talk of a vaccine or whatever it may be, and I might know more about that case. But same with racing with you, Ruby. I'm sure, you know, racing might have had there for a few weeks behind closed doors, and it seemed to work very well. I don't know what's holding that up now, going ahead again. It gives so many people, you know, if you're going to be cocooned in your house or locked up or can't go to work, these sort of things give you that little bit of something to watch, to cling to get you some enjoyment, because it's life at the end of the day. You have to live your life. We can't spend it like this for the next year. You know, you have to keep going and trying to find solutions to these problems.
I would be in your camp, Kevin, and I can understand that people would say, well, look, different families, different people have different circumstances, different backgrounds where they're going home to, but everybody is going to have to be responsible for their own actions, and when they walk out the door, decide where they're going and what they're going to do. Do you think you could give soccer players the option? Will clubs even give them the option? Yeah. Can you say, look, you're in or you're out?
Yeah, I know, and there's been a couple of players that come out and said they're not comfortable playing. I suppose they're adults. You have to say, if you're not comfortable playing, you're not comfortable playing. You can't force anyone to do anything. But I think the sports people, we're young, fit, healthy. You want to be out. You want to be out playing. You'll have a couple who might say, listen, I don't know, I have a family member maybe or in the background who's not that well. But again, if you're cocooning in a hotel with your teammates and you're not seeing anyone from the outside world for 6 weeks, that should solve that issue. But listen, they're adults. If they want to not play, they won't, but I would imagine 99% of all athletes, you know, the paper will interview the one who doesn't want to play and make a headline out of it, but 99% of lads will want to get out there. They'll know the story. If you're young, fit, healthy, if we have to stay in a hotel for 6 weeks to get this season finished, so be it. The ones you'll say, no, cancel now, are the ones who haven't done their job right. The West Ham's looking for any excuse to get the season over with and null and void it. Norwich's, you know, they shouldn't be given that escape. It annoys me seeing them come out and having their, you know, tuppence on it. So just finish this season. It's just as important as next year. And yeah, you'll have most of it. I'm sure you'd agree with jockeys and trainers and all, the 99%, you might have one or two who'll say, listen, I'm stepping away, but 99% are just desperate to get going. And we'll adhere to every sort of criteria, and they'll be wanting to stay healthy. They don't want to catch a virus. They'll be doing everything to do it as well as possible while adhering to the rules and regulations.
But there are some big players who have come out and said they're not comfortable. Like Aguero, for example, said that he's scared, and some other Premier League players are scared about it. So you kind of have to be cognizant of their feelings as well.
Yeah, I know, and I suppose it's easy for me to sit here and be tired and not affecting me, but I'm trying to put myself in that position when I was playing. You know, Aguero saying that, but, you know, Man City have about 50 players in their squad, the other 49 aren't saying, so get on with it. Okay, Sergio, perfect, you can stay at home and look after yourself, but we'll go ahead. You know, I don't think you have a vote on it, maybe. The majority rules on it. If, listen, you're getting into different issues, but I think it can be solved if it's gone about the right way. And grown men, let them make up their own mind. I would think you get the vast majority. And not playing because they're under pressure to play, or the club is bullying them into playing. They're all grown-ups. They make own decisions. They're well able to negotiate contracts and throw ties out of pram when they want to leave clubs or vice versa. So they let their point be known. But I would think everyone just wants to get on with it. We've had our 2 months now, and everyone's tried very hard to do it, and we're all very aware of the situation, aware of what we have to do, aware of you know, how we keep ourselves within reason away from the virus and you know.
And Kevin, what if somebody does get sick though? If a player, like we know Arteta had it, like if a player gets sick, then what?
Well, they're fit young fellas, and you have to hope that they're going, as I said, I give this solution, they go into a hotel, they're quarantined, they're 4 weeks now, say you start the 1st of June with the Premier League. League of Ireland is a whole different thing and different things like that. Lower leagues, you can't afford the finances of maybe cocooning in a hotel, but 4 weeks now of getting yourself ready, tested, okay, you don't have the virus, then you're cocooned in a hotel, and you hope you do everything right that no one catches it. You know, that would be the idea of having a squad, a match day, doctors, whoever, the minimum amount of people needed to play a game. You know, it's ballooned now to about 70 people travel to a game between analysts and everything like that. But go back to 10 or 15 years ago and you had 18 people on a bus going to a game. So it can be done. It can. You don't need as many people as they say. If Sky are wanting to show the game, like people would watch me video on Liverpool on my iPhone now and watch it live for 90 minutes. You don't need 25 cameras and all those people at games. You don't need all the commentators and pitchside reporters. You can do it a lot less with a lot less numbers than they're saying, if they just go back to maybe where they were 15 or 20 years ago and do as well as possible. And there is obviously the potential of someone getting the virus, but you hope, you know, out of the 500-odd people in the players in the Premier League, that if one gets it, that they're young, fit and healthy enough and they'll be absolutely fine and they're cocooned and they won't be spreading it to their family or outside that circle. And, you know, with them being such fit athletes, it shouldn't be an issue. You know, that might sound cruel and unkind, but you know what do you do? You could get it going to Tesco tomorrow. Like, how careful can you possibly be? You know, you can go for a jog down the road and you could be unlucky enough to be someone coughing or jogging by. Like, where do you draw the line of your safety, your personal safety? I think, you know, fit athletic players on a pitch, whether it's football or golfers out playing golf, professional golfers, you know, the perfect sport, the social distance. You know, there's certain things are easier to do than others, and I think it can be a way to get forward. We have to go forward. We can't just sit like this, hoping there's a vaccine or whatever it might be, mightn't come. So, you know, we have to try to get ways.
I agree, because sport has to show the way forward, Kevin. You were saying with soccer players, be it horse racing, be it golf, tennis. Sport is there to entertain, but it's also there to be inspired. And if soccer players, jockeys, etc., footballers are held up as role models for everything else they do in life, now is the time to be a role model and show people how to get back out and get going.
Yeah, exactly. Show a strength and a courage and a lack of fear and do the thing right and show that if you do, you know, all the things right and the protocols right, you can hopefully get the world going again. And like I said, inspire people. Give people a reason to smile most days. They're sitting home, they're wanting something to be passionate about again, to be excited about, to see that the world is starting to go around again. Because we can't just, we'll all find problems and I can come up with 25 different reasons why you shouldn't go ahead, but we can't not go ahead. We can't not have sport, we can't not have most of the things that make lives worth living, whether it be sport or whatever people's passions are. They have to go ahead. We have to get going again. We can't say, oh, we'll do it next year when we have a vaccine. It's just not possible. There's so many, you know, financial, first of all, clubs won't be here to do it if we keep delaying it. You know, we're going to horse racing. There's a million different industries within that industry that, you know, need horse racing to go ahead and go ahead soon. So it's just being clever about it, being intelligent about it, doing it the right way, being PR side of it, getting that all right, being shown, you know, getting the news across that you're doing everything social distance-wise and as professional as you can to make sure you're not spreading the virus. Get people on your side. But I think the majority of the population would be happy to see sport going ahead and realise that they're doing everything they can within reason to not be spreading the virus. And that, you know, what else can you say? That's my view on it. Other people, if it's affecting your family or someone's had a loved one, you know, pass away from it, they would be listening to me, I'm sure, and going, I wish he'd shut up and, you know, maybe cough on a bit. But that's my opinion.
You're entitled to your opinion like the rest of us, and mine would be something similar. Thanks a million for taking our call, and I hope someone was listening to you.
No worries. Thanks, Louis. Thanks, Murray.
Thanks. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On this Tuesday evening. And whilst the rest of Ireland and England, I suppose, wait to see what's going to happen with soccer. There has been some developments all across Europe, and to join us on the line to explain what's going on and who's going to start is Mark Langdon. Mark, how are you?
Yourself?
Great, thank God. Mark, we'll start with La Liga. They look like they're going to be back training fairly soon.
Yeah, that's right. The government have allowed Spanish teams to return to training this week, in terms of it will be a bit like it is at the Premier League at the moment, where it's social distance training, and that basically is just cardio, some running around or whatever. It's seen as safer to be, in terms of a training ground rather than in a park or something like that. By, I think it's around about the 18th of May, teams will be able to involve themselves in sort of more competitive training, still with social distancing, and that they're looking at, there's going to be a disinfectant at training grounds. They're talking about doing the same thing with footballs and the pitch, and so it's not going to be sort of training as the footballers know it, but it will be the first step really to looking to get La Liga back by the middle of June, which of course is roughly around about the same time that the Premier League is looking to start. But not everybody is happy. Eibar have released a statement only a couple of hours ago questioning the decision for La Liga to aim to return, questioning whether it's safe to do so, and the players saying that they're really unsure that they want to come back, and this is a collective statement, rather than one or two players going out on their own. I suppose some people would say that Eibar, in threat of relegation, maybe have got other reasons for not wanting to come back, but it's a very, I suppose, personal choice, isn't it, as to whether you do want to play football again.
Will they give the players a personal choice, do you think, Mark?
I suppose they will, in respect of if a player doesn't want to play, then he doesn't have to. But the players' unions all seem to be sort of heading towards a restart as well. It's the consequences of not finishing these seasons could be absolutely catastrophic for teams, and not many people want to talk about the money side of it, but in terms of the Bundesliga and the second division, it's been explained that roughly half the teams in the top two divisions would be in threat of going bust if they don't finish this season. In France, of course, the government are set to prop up the TV money. They've cancelled their season and sort of decided it on the current league standings, and the government are paying out around about €250 million to make sure that teams still receive some kind of compensation that will be missing from the media companies. But that's not possible in Germany. It's around about it's at least double that figure that they're talking about. So if players, it's sort of put to them that to the players that if they don't come back now, there may not be anything for them to come back to whenever the new season starts.
And Mark, Angela Merkel is due to make a big statement tomorrow, or release a statement tomorrow in Germany. Is there any indications as to what might be in that?
Yeah, so it's been reported that Angela Merkel meets with the 20 state leaders tomorrow. In Germany, is broken down kind of region by region, that there's a lot of influence to each sort of state leader, if you like. So she has this meeting with 20 of those. It's been reported that football will be given the green light to return next week, which would be a start date of the 15th of May, which would make it by far the quickest return to action in terms of the major leagues. Now, of course, something could happen overnight and things change, but the way it's looking at the moment, the way it's being briefed off the record, is that football will be allowed to return. Of course, the German teams have been back in training for a while now. They're a good few weeks ahead of the Premier League and La Liga and also Serie A. So the players are kind of ready. They're testing a lot for the coronavirus. 10 positive tests so far since they started the testing, and that's not just players that have been tested. That's all kinds of sort of staff that are linked to the teams, and that they've decided that is a kind of acceptable number, if you like, for them to carry on. Those players that test positive are isolating for a fortnight, but they don't see it as a situation where, let's say, Bayern Munich played Borussia Dortmund and somebody tested positive after that game, that both teams would have to go into isolation. They believe that the testing that they've got in place would mean that it would just be, say, you know, that player that tested positive, he would have to go into isolation. So the Germans have put out a plan in action. It's a 31-point plan. I think they're a lot clearer in their minds as to what they want to do. The Premier League, it feels like they're coming up with a new idea each day to try to appease everybody, whereas the Germans have got, you know, they've got a goal, an end goal. Most of the sort of, well, all of the teams that have bought into it, most of the players have as well. You're not getting the kind of criticism that I mentioned about earlier there with Eibar, or Sergio Aguero's come out, hasn't he, in recent times and said he's not sure. In Germany, it's not like that. I think most people have bought into what they're trying to do in terms of finishing the season.
I saw pictures of Cristiano Ronaldo on a private jet heading back to Italy after 2 months in Portugal in lockdown. So he seems to be set to go back playing anyway.
Yes, I'm not entirely sure he was 100% about it. He seemed to be having a good time in Madeira, the kind of island was just catering to his every demand, really. He was training alone on the football pitch, and he had a good spot back in his homeland. But I'm surprised that the Serie A is kind of on the same sort of trajectory, if you like, as the Premier League and La Liga. I thought because of the problems they'd had in Italy, it maybe would have been even further behind. But again, there is this desire, almost a need, to finish the season, and all 20 teams in the top flight are determined to do just that, which means that all of the foreign stars have been recalled from wherever they've been in the world. You've had the South Americans have gone home to Brazil and Argentina, etc. So they're all being recalled. There'll be 2 weeks kind of period before they, you know, get down to the serious business of preparing to finish what would, you know, the most surreal season probably in history.
Mark, we know that Project Restart was launched on Friday for the Premier League. There's been little information and detail on really when it will potentially return and in what form. We're kind of hearing little bits of drip-feeding news of maybe behind or in neutral venues or shorter halves like we heard today. When will we get some clarity on the Premier League, do you think?
I think that, well, it has to be, UEFA have set a date, which is in late May, I think it's around about the 25th, 26th of May, when the UEFA want to know from each individual kind of association what they're going to do. So that they've got roughly around about another 20 days to iron out the remaining issues. Of course, there's a lot of self-interest at the moment in the Premier League, with teams at the bottom maybe looking to protect themselves against relegation, teams at the top looking to protect themselves from, you know, the huge potential revenue loss there. So a lot, like I said, there's a lot of self-interest, whereas I think in Germany at least, it feels like they've come together for what they believe to be the good of the German game, to get the season finished, and you're not having the kind of rows that you're seeing in the Premier League. I'm not sure how it will end in terms of this Premier League battle. It could be in financial compensation, so that there's more money for teams that are relegated. You know, there's talk of maybe taking away one of the relegation spots, so only two teams go down. It would be best, I think, if they could come to a unanimous decision on this. But what suits Brighton probably doesn't suit Manchester United, and that's a big problem for the Premier League. And I don't think at the absolute top of the Premier League, in terms of Richard Scudamore, when he was there, it felt like they were all pulling in the same direction. It feels a little bit rudderless at the moment, and I think this is one that could go, you know, right the way until the UEFA deadline towards the end of May.
Well, hopefully, Mark, we'll be dialing you in soon to see who's starting for Bayern Munich when they're playing Borussia Dortmund. Thanks a million for taking our call. We're going to take
Thanks,
a break.
Ricky.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On this day in 1997, Ken Doherty scaled to the summit of world snooker when he became the first player from the Republic of Ireland to lift the World Snooker Championship trophy.
There's no better feeling in the world. Ken Doherty thoroughly deserves this World Championship title. He's a great friend of Stephen Hendry, and Stephen Hendry will be back, I'm sure, to claim his seventh. But at the moment, Sheffield and the Crucible Theatre belongs to Ken Doherty, who beat Stephen Hendry 18-12 to become the 1997 World Champion.
Now, Ken Doherty joins us on the line. Ken, it was surely a night to remember for sports fans. What was it like for you?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, just, you know, when you hear those, the words and the crowd cheering, and you sort of relive the memories over and over again, and it sort of, it, you know, it gives you goosebumps even listening to it now. They showed it just a little bit on the TV during the week, and you never get tired of seeing those pictures. And it's something like, you know, when I started out as a kid, I watched Alex Higgins win the World Championship in 1982, and that was it. I was hooked on snooker. I saw Dennis Taylor lifting the trophy in 85 when the whole country stopped, and they were the images that stood with me. And just to lift that trophy, give it a big kiss, and then wave it up to you know, all the friends that were up in the balcony there, was just it was amazing. A dream come true.
And the approach to that final clash, what was it like for you? Were you nervous?
Yeah, I mean, I was playing Stephen Hendry, you know, who... It was almost like his home table, because he hadn't been beaten in the previous 5 years. He was going for six in a row. So he won 29 matches in a row. An incredible record. And I was going in. I was a huge underdog. There's no doubt about it. But it was funny. Like, that week, I sort of dreamt every night going to bed. I mean, it's strange to think about it now. But every night going to bed, I could see myself lifting that cup the way Higgins did and the way Taylor did, giving it a big kiss. And that sort of helped me relax a little bit. I mean, people, you know, sports psychologists talk about visualization all the time, but that's what it was like for me. I could just see myself, and it calmed me down. I was, like, quite relaxed going into the final. You know, I was smiling and laughing and joking, a bit like Dennis did in 85 and interacting with the crowd. And that sort of helped me as well. And I think it might have sort of upset Stephen, because, you know, most people who would have played Stephen in the previous finals, they would have been very, very nervous. And, you know, I was sort of shown a little bit more emotion, and it might have upset him, thinking, Jenny, this guy is sort of, you know, enjoying this atmosphere. You know, what do I have to do to beat him? But eventually worked, and, you know, to lift the trophy and beat Stephen, I think, was the icing on the cake for sure.
But Ken, to get to a final, you obviously have to win a lot of rounds. I mean, you'd beaten Steve Davis, John Higgins, Alan Robidoux. Yeah. To get there, that surely gave you great confidence going in to take on Stephen Hendry.
Yeah, and the funny thing, Ruby, like, before that, coming into that World Championship, you know, I had a terrible season. I needed to win my first match at the World Championship just to stay in the top 16. So that was like a final for me in itself. And I just scraped over the line against a guy called Mark Davis, who's still playing now, and I beat him 10-8. But you're right, I played Steve Davis in the very next round, who destroyed me in Goffs at the Irish Masters 6-1, destroyed me in the Masters in London 6-1 as well. But when I won that first match against Mark Davis, it's sort of a big weight it lifted off me, and I went out and played some of the best snooker ever. I beat Steve Davis 13-3 with a session to spare. Then I beat John Higgins, and then Elaine Robidoux, as you said, in the semi-final. So, you know, from nothing... And you know from sport itself, sometimes even when you're having a bad run, just one thing can change your whole outlook. And that match in the very first round against Mark Davis just completely changed me.
In my game, it's a winner. In yours, is one ball dropping for you. But when you took on Stephen Hendry in the final, you won the first frame. He won the next two, so he's 2-1 up. And then you just went on a run. And you won frames 4, 5, 6 and 7. Like, you must have been buzzing.
I was buzzing. You know, we played 8 frames in the fourth session of that World Championship final, and Stephen Hendry made 3 centuries in the 8 frames, and I was still 5-3 up. So that gave me a lot of confidence. You know, I wasn't winning frames. I didn't have one century in the final, funny enough, you know, but, and Stephen Hendry had five centuries. But I was winning a lot of frames with 50s, 60s, or clearing the last few reds, the colours. And I was sticking with him all the time. And I was one of those type of players who played a sort of a good all-round game. I couldn't outscore Stephen Hendry because nobody could at the height of his game. But what I could do, I couldn't out-pot him either because he was such a great long putter. But what I could do was match him with really good match play, tight snooker and safety play. And that's how I started creating chances for myself. But yeah, after that first session, it sort of settled me down into the final. It gave me great confidence, you know. And he's a frightening player. And Stephen Hendry, you know, he dominated the cruise, dominated snooker for the whole of the 90s. But he was a frightening player. And if he got ahead of you, he was one of those great front runners, a bit like the way Ronnie O'Sullivan is today.
And when you're facing off against someone as ruthless as him, and you're in the middle of the game and you're in the situation that you're in, what are you thinking about?
The funny thing is, you just got to concentrate in your own game. Snooker is one of those games that, you know, you're sitting in the chair and your opponent's at the table and you can do nothing until he misses, you know. And that's one of the toughest things about snooker. So you mentally have to be very, very strong just to wait for your chances. But, you know, when the chances come along, then you've got to take them, you know. But when you're playing, an adversary like Stephen Hendry, you've just got to have belief, you know. Confidence is a huge thing. The psychological part of the game is very, very strong in snooker, and you've got to be on your toes all the time. So, and of course, you know, when you have the fighting Irish spirit like we all do, that's hard to beat as well.
Stephen or Ken, when you're there and you're 15-8 up, and then he starts to peg you back, and he gets you all the way back to 15-12, you're sitting there watching him potting and winning and potting and winning. What are you thinking then?
Oh, I was thinking, please, not now. That's what I was saying to myself in the chair. I was 15. I was 15, actually, 7. He won the last two frames of that session to go 15-9. And then the first three frames of the evening session, he won in quick succession, 15-12. And in that frame, I'm just thinking, because he'd beaten Jimmy White from a long way behind. He won 10 frames in a row in one of the finals. He'd beaten Mike Hallett from 8-2 behind to win another final, 9-8. So I've seen him do it over the years, and I was thinking to myself, please, not now, not me, no, not in the final of the World Championship. Don't make this incredible comeback. And the funny thing happened in that 28th frame. It was the last frame before our mid-session interval. I made a 60 break, missed a red. Stephen got in, and he was clearing up with two reds left. And he left a tight red along the top cushion, just behind the black, and he rolled it into the corner pocket, trying to get on the black. And it just stayed in the jaws of the pocket, and I jumped out of my chair. I was like you on the back of a horse, Ruby. I was out of the chair like a shot to the table, potted the red and black, and I was 16-12. And then the pressure was released, and I went to the interval feeling I'd sort of got over that big hurdle, and then I came out and won 17-12, 18-12 in the end.
The celebrations looked like they were good crack as well.
Oh, they were great crack. Yeah, I had a few people over from Dublin. None of my family were there at all. They were all in Ranelagh. You know, the house was full of like people from RTÉ Sport and some of the papers as well. And because none of the family could hardly, they wouldn't have been able to come out. They were just too nervous. So they said they'll stay home. My mother, I didn't know where she was. She was in one of the church. I think she ended up in Donnybrook Church lighting candles and had to walk home because she got a puncture and a bicycle. The friends that were there, I mean, Niall Quinn was there and Eamon Dunphy was there, Newey Copeland were there, but my other friends, my old coach, Paddy Miley, Pat Caulfield, Nick McLean, they were all there as well. And you could hear the big cheer when I potted those last few balls. It was just fantastic, you know.
That line in your interview afterwards, perhaps my mother will stop nagging me about getting a proper job, will stay with you forever.
Yeah, she used to say that to me all the time, would you not get a real job, you know, and relieve me of all this tension and pressure, like, you know. But it was worth it, you know, when I came home and she was there at the bottom of the stairs getting off the plane, and I gave her the cup and she gave it a big kiss, and I think that was a special moment. She used to put it on the top of our TV, you know, in Ranelagh Avenue there, and it'd be on top and she'd be showing it every day, and the door was always open. Anybody wanted to come in and get a picture with that year, the door was always open. There was never a problem at all.
Obviously, we should. Well, not we. I wouldn't be there, but obviously the Crucible should be on right now. Ken, and it's not. It's going to be played later in the summer. Thank God. And Judd Trump is the world number one at the minute. Would he be the one to beat?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's been so difficult these last couple of weeks. You know, the final would have been yesterday, and you know, not to have it on was just it's just very, very sad. You know, and for all sporting occasions, but particularly for snooker players, we look forward to these couple of weeks every year. You know, they're always earmarked in the calendar. And yeah, Judd Trump, you know, he played brilliantly last year to win it, and of course no first time champion has ever come back to defend the title, so they call it the Crucible Course, or so it would have been interesting to see whether he could come back and defend the title. But hopefully they have 2 weeks available now in July, which would have been for the Olympics. So there is a window of opportunity there for the BBC and for World Snooker to stage it. But that remains a possibility, depending on what Boris Johnson says now when he gives a speech, I think, later on this week, and let us know what's going to be in store for us over the next few months.
Ken, it was so glamorous back in the days around the 90s when you were lifting the big trophies. Will it ever go back to those days, do you think?
Well, I don't know whether there'll be another Irish person. Hopefully there will be. You know, the game has expanded exponentially around the world. I mean, maybe not in Ireland or the UK, but certainly in Europe, because of Eurosport, they're shown so much snooker on TV, and they've signed a 10-year extension to the contract. And, of course, in Asia, you know, it's amazing. We talk about the figures that watch snooker, but it's almost like Formula One figures. I mean, Ding Junhui was in the final of the World Championship a few years ago, and they reckoned it was 500 million people watching it across the whole Asian seaboard. So that's where the game has like expanded incredibly. So, I don't know whether we're going to see those type of times, because over here, a lot of new clubs are closing down because of, like, you know, the prices, and, you know, it's so much more difficult than it is now than it would have been, you know, when I started off to have a snooker club. But, daunting times for people in Ireland and even in the UK now for snooker, but across the world it's a different game at all.
So today's the Irish Masters, filling the auditorium and Goffs are a distant memory, aren't they?
Yeah, great times. I mean, you came out, your dad, lots of the horse racing family used to turn up there every year. It's just fantastic. We still have the Irish Seniors Masters there, which is held now the last couple of years, which is brilliant, you know. But the atmosphere when Goffs is on, and when I played there, or I remember watching Dennis Taylor play Alex Higgins there, and it was the handshake, you know, after the famous fight that they had when they played for the Irish team. Like, the atmosphere there was just, there was nothing like it. It was such a special place for snooker. And I don't think it'll get to the heights for the seniors, but at least there is a little bit of snooker there. There's great history there.
Well, Ken, you certainly gave us many, many great memories. So thanks so much for that. And hopefully we'll get snooker back playing again soon. It does seem like a social distancing type of sport that could work.
Yeah, well, it's one of those, isn't it? Particularly when I'm playing, because I'm sitting in my chair most of the time. But yeah, hopefully, fingers crossed.
Thanks so much, Ken.
Cheers, Ken.
My pleasure. Thanks, really. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Ken Doherty, pretty special guy. Ruby gave us some great memories.
Ah, sure. Look, I mean, how many world champions are there in Ireland? So Ken Doherty is one. And I remember that was clear as day, watching it on the BBC late at night. But it wasn't that late, but watching him beating Stephen Hendry. And even like Stephen Hendry had won the previous five. And to think that there was someone from Dublin going to go and beat him was incredible.
It was amazing to hear how much the game is spread around the world. While it's kind of contracted here, we don't see as much of it. It's massive, as he said, in Asia.
500 million people in Asia watching it.
The glamour of it being here in Ireland isn't really a priority for them anymore, I'd say.
Get the whole country to watch it, and 5 million have looked at it. Then you drop in the ocean compared to what's watching it in Asia. But look, there's lots of sports like that too, isn't there? I mean, even you watch the European Tour, European Golf Tour, how far across the world it has spread to reach its audience. That's just the way things are going.
Yeah. Now, moving on to, I was going to say hockey, but more motorsport, I think. But Nikki Daly is a hockey player and a world silver medalist, and she has been very busy for the last few months. She assembled an all-star cast of Irish sportswomen and a few all-star. Maybe who I wouldn't say all-star as well. And she got everyone to do a lap of Mondello Park, and she made a documentary about it, and she joins us on the line now. Nikki, you've been busy.
Yeah, I have. Thanks for having me, Marie and Ruby. Yeah, today's the day that it goes on the RTE Player, the Formula Female One Lap Challenge. So it's really exciting to finally get it up there.
So tell us a little bit about why you did it and where the idea came from.
So the idea actually came from, it was kind of between myself and Nicole Drought, who's Ireland's top female racing driver. And, you know, we're very passionate about the 20 by 20 campaign and, you know, increasing the visibility of females in all different sports. And we felt that motorsport was one that definitely needed a bit of raising of the profile. So we took on the 20 by 20 Show Your Stripes pledge, and we decided to bring down, as you said, 15 of the best female sports women in the country, to showcase a little bit of how, you know, they could get on in a car and see how they like a stint in motorsport.
Well, I haven't seen it yet because we're having a viewing party later on this evening hosted by Elaine Buckley, but I did it along with lots of famous sportswomen, Lindsay Peat, Aisling Thompson, Áine O'Gorman, Jackie Hurley and Elaine Buckley, as I mentioned, plus lots and lots more. But I wasn't very good, Nikki.
Well, I believe that's the reason that we're having this Zoom party, because everyone's so excited to see your laugh, Marie. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about it yourself.
Well, I just didn't really feel the need for speed. It was probably the wrong thing to go and do. But look, you asked me to do it and I said I'd do it. And I think you call me driving Miss Daisy, or else I looked like I was going out to get my shopping as opposed to doing a lap of Mondello.
Yeah, I'd say you probably took in the scenery around Mondello Park as well, which is very beautiful. So,
Marie, I just assumed you were going to do, you were doing a Donegal this, like, to promote a show that you were on. I assumed you'd won it. How could you go and promote a show that you finished last in?
Well, you know, it's you know, I'm part of a team now, doing it for the team. I'm okay with it, you know. It's fine.
That's
your
it.
Sister
There's
did
a
it.
For everyone in motorsport, that's what it shows.
Exactly. And Katie, I was there when Katie Walsh was there, and the day she was doing it, and I barely saw her. She was so fast. I'm looking forward to see her time, but Ruby, she's definitely comfortable with speed.
She wouldn't be afraid to drive a car a bit quicker maybe than she should, or Kate, so she wouldn't, but each to their own, I suppose. But Nikki, I suppose motorsport was always in your life. I mean, your dad Vivian and your uncle Derek, you were spent mm-hmm. half your life in Mondello reading about it.
Yeah, I suppose that's the first sport I was probably ever introduced to, and that's all I kind of knew at the weekends, was going down to Mondello Park to watch my dad race. And then obviously my uncle had his own career in F1 and IndyCar, and then his son Connor Daly came up through the ranks as well, so he's now racing in IndyCar in the States. So it's just been something that's been in my life since I was born, and I definitely developed a passion for it, and now I can't you know, get enough of it.
I know you're trying to raise the awareness for awareness even for women. Can you ever see a woman competing in Formula One?
I can, yeah, and I think that you know, initiatives like, I know the 20 by 20 is an all-sport initiative, but even things like that where, you know, you can showcase female talent in every sport to the younger generation of young girls. You know, there's another, there's an all-female racing series now that's just been set up last year called the W Series. And it basically brings in the top female racing drivers and gives them an opportunity, a fully paid-for opportunity for them to showcase their talent and to then go on and get other opportunities in the sport. And I think that providing these, you know, talented girls with these opportunities will eventually lead to somebody getting to Formula One. And also by having, you know, the more you can show it, like you said, that visibility is such an important part for any young girl. And if they can't see it, they can't see it. And I think that the more that it is out there, you know, the more young girls can realise that this is something that they can actually do themselves. So I think we will see it, but I do think it's probably a little bit away for right now.
Results are the key to success in any sport, and with motorsport, it's all times, it's all laps and lap times. How are the women drivers doing in comparison to the men? I really can't see how there is a difference, but the data should be there.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, we have Nicole Drought here in this country, and she went and won an endurance race last year. It was the first time any woman had won a race in that category. So, you know, that goes to show you there's so many different forms of motorsport. So it's hard to compare. You know, you've got Jamie Chadwick, who's competing again in one of the highest levels sort of in Great Britain. You had Danica Patrick, who is from the States, who was the first female to win an IndyCar race. So, you know, there is proof there that women can do it. Our own Rosemary Smith, the legend herself, you know, that that it can be done. And I think it's just the more, it's like anything, the more you have representing on a female basis, that the better chance you have of them making it to the top.
Nikki, that goes for all sports. And we are seeing you on social media displaying your fantastic hockey skills as well. Can't see, can't be, female role model right there. How has training been going? I know the Olympics is postponed, but I'm sure you're still keeping fit.
Yeah, doing as much as I can. I think, you know, everyone's in the same position. All the sports people and all the different sports are finding it tough. But I'm lucky in the sense that I have a bit of space where I live, and I've got a nice tough uphill mountain that I can run every day, and I have a bit of a gym kind of made out the back. So just trying to keep, you know, the body ticking over as much as you can. And yeah, any bit of a stick and ball that you can get doing each day will just help and kind of help the mind more than anything.
And just in terms of staying connected with the team, are you doing Zooms? Are you on WhatsApps at the moment? What's the plan for the next while?
We've done a couple of the Zoom quizzes, and just trying to keep in touch a little bit here and there. Obviously, not a lot we can do. We kind of have a program set out for us, and it doesn't look like maybe we'll get back on the pitch till July. So that's kind of what we're aiming for. But then in the meantime, it's just trying to look after ourselves and be ready to go then come July.
I'm assuming this party you're having to watch on the RTE player is a Zoom party as well, like, is it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think the interest has been really high, and I've seen the girls having the banter there on Twitter. There's a few rivalries that have gone on just before this one challenge, so it'll be exciting to see how that rivalry plays out in the documentary this evening.
I'm really looking forward to it, Nikki. So it's on the RTE player and we can watch it from tonight?
Yeah, it should be up there. I think it was going on up after this interview, maybe. Or
brilliant.
I think 6:30 it was going up on the player. I have heard that maybe people are having a bit of trouble logging on to the RTE player in general. So hopefully that's just a small little glitch and it'll be up there as soon as possible.
Fantastic, Nikki. Thanks so much for joining us. That is all
Cheers,
we have
Nikki.
Time for on Game On.
Game On 2FM.